This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In this presidential election year, a lot of political analysts talk about red states, blue states, and 50-50 America. In a new book, two British journalists argue that no matter who wins the White House, conservatives will set the political agenda and that they have assumed the role as the natural party of government. For a new book called The Right Nation, John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge traveled around the country to find out how and why a once marginal movement rose to dominate the mainstream of American politics and to explain why American conservatism is so different from the right in other developed countries. Later in the program, the House of Representatives considers how to reform itself in the event of a catastrophic attack on Congress. One idea requires a constitutional amendment. But first, conservative power in America. If you have questions about players from Joseph McCarthy to Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan, about the role of ideology, religion, and tax revolts, about why so many Americans regard conservatism as the politics of change, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Adrian Wooldridge, co-author of The Right Nation. He's also Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. Good to have you back on the program.
Good afternoon.
And joining us from London is John Micklethwaite, who's The Economist's U.S. editor. And good to have you back as well.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
John, let's begin with you. In the book, you write that classical conservatism differs from the American variety in some important ways. Basically, why is American conservatism, you've come to the conclusion, American conservatism is really unique, exceptional, you say?
It is very different, and it's particularly different if you come at it from some degree of outside perspective. Quite simply, if you look at other countries, they don't have a conservative movement. There isn't a religious right really anywhere in Europe. There isn't something like Fox News. There isn't Rush Limbaugh. There isn't the vast array of troops who one sees on the right in America. And it's not just that. It's also a question of ideology. It's partly organization, but it's also a question of ideology. If you look at the old principles of classical conservatism, as people like Edmund Burke laid down, some of those ones, the American conservatism has exaggerated, like, say, patriotism. American conservatives tend to be much more patriotic than other forms of conservatives everywhere, not just because they have many more flags, but also because they are much less willing to allow their nation to be mixed up with other nations in the same way as virtually every European conservative has allowed their nation to get enmeshed in the European Union. So that's sort of one bit of in which Americans are different. But the other bit in which American conservatives are different, I think, is that actually they've imported at least a strand, and they may hate this word, of liberalism. They, things like, for instance, old classical conservatives used to love the idea that it was really about elites, that it was really about feudal squires who knew that everyone had to keep their place in society. All the heroes of Western conservatism, Western American conservatism, are people who started from nothing. They're entrepreneurs who build a business out of nothing. They are, of course, the cowboy, the kind of quintessential loner. And that's a very different view. I mean, you can go through all the different other attributes, things like religion, where, again, America is an extreme version of old classical conservatism. And on the other hand, things like populism, America basically subverts the entire thing. It's keener on having a populist trait. So in international terms, at least, and it's been a slightly long-winded answer to your question, it is different, both in terms of the movement it's created, which is completely unlike anything on this side of the Atlantic, and secondly, in terms of its beliefs.
Adrian Wooldridge, you guys traveled around the country to a lot of different places to explore this. And in a sense, though, I get the impression this is a bit of a travelogue to explain what you call the right nation to, well, not only to people in San Francisco and New York, places that might not understand conservatism as well as places like Colorado Springs, a place you visit, or Texas, but to Europeans who may be utterly befuddled by this phenomenon.
Absolutely. We found that a lot of the roots of conservatism are in parts of the country that many people who live on the east or the west coasts don't go to that much, and which certainly people who visit the United States from Europe don't actually go to that much, namely the suburbs, the south, Texas, places like Colorado. And we thought it was absolutely vital, if one is going to understand this extraordinary country, that one has to understand the red states. One has to understand the roots, as it were, of conservative and Republican ideology. So we spent a lot of time traveling around those places, and very friendly and welcoming they were.
Mm-hmm. As you begin the book, you take a look at this community in Colorado Springs, a community that embraces a number of different strands of modern conservatism, and let's not, you know, it's a big tent, but there are very distinctive strands to American journalism. Describe a few of them that you encountered there.
Absolutely. There's the anti-tax strand, which, you know, never raise my taxes, propositions which prevent the governor or the legislature from raising taxes without getting absolute explicit consent from the population. There's the religious strand, which is extraordinarily powerful, focused on the family, is headquartered there in Colorado Springs, as are a number of different religious organizations. And then there's the nationalist strand, which is the flag-waving strand, which believes in the assertion of American power, which is embodied most obviously in military bases, in enthusiasm for the military. And there are tensions between these strands, between the anti-government strand, the religious strand, and the nationalist strand. But there are also an extraordinary number of ways in which they manage to live with each other and get on with each other. A lot of similarities as well.
Mm-hmm. Yet there are, and let's go back to John Micklethwaite for this, there are certainly, as you also point out, that while you argue conservatives have come to dominate politics in this country, you point out that there are millions of Americans who would I think, as you put it at one point in the book, would rather die than ever vote Republican.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really we're not trying to argue that every American is a conservative. That would be mad. You only have to look at the people who've clustered around Howard Dean, or indeed Ralph Nader, or indeed John Kerry, to say that isn't true. But what is interesting, very interesting, is the idea that there is this vast body of Americans who take a very conservative view. If you look at the polls now, 2 out of every 5 Americans identify themselves as conservatives, 41%. That's now twice as many as the number who identify themselves as liberals. And that's astounding, because as you introduced the program, it's amazing. You go back to the 1960s, and back then you had people like J.K. Galbraith saying, everyone now is a liberal. And at the time when Goldwater ran, the basic response to Goldwater was, firstly, he was a slightly eccentric candidate, but even more so, he was somebody who represented an ideology which seemed profoundly un-American, was a quote which got often thrown at him in that sense. Now, suddenly, you have a much more conservative president than Goldwater, I think, would ever have been. And he represents a very vibrant part of America. And it's not just a matter of a lot of people thinking about these things. I think, and this is probably going to annoy liberals, but we try to do it as objectively as possible. If you look at the way that the ideas war has been waged over the past couple of decades, conservatives have been winning a lot of the wars, even when Democrat presidents have been there.
The centre has shifted to the right, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And the centre is certainly to the right when you compare the American centre with the centre of virtually any other country. I mean, that is an incredible thing looking from across here, is that when you look at, say, the British Conservative Party, which, remember, is the party which American Republicans repeatedly refer to as the one which is the closest to them in terms of their intellectual roots, and yet by many measures the British Conservatives are actually, in terms of ideology, now quite a lot closer to Democrats. Various people have pointed out that there is very little difference between their type of approach to the Iraq War and John Kerry's, for instance.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Frank, who joins us on the line from Oakland, California.
Hello. I have a brief comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
The comment is, I think there's somewhat of a misnomer in your use of the word conservative, and the situation is actually much more complex. I myself am bicultural. I've lived in France for a long time and also in the U.S. and speak French fluently, and I keep up to date on European news, English reporting, and French. And I'd like to say that I think conservatism has changed in the last 40 years in this country, and in large part, I think, due to large expenditures in campaign contributions, which is a form of lobbying, and particularly within the conservative movement. So you have traditional conservatives, and then you have sort of the money conservatives, and they're the ones who are actually have the power and are leading it through consolidation of the media and advertising. And that on the other side, you have sort of a populist people who are basically have integrity and they're conservative, but they're not well informed. And I think that if you took the European political system, and this is my question, and you did not have limits on campaign contributions the way it is in most of Europe, everybody spends the same amount of money, and often it's financed by the government, you would end up with something very similar. And if you took the U.S. system and applied campaign contribution limits, you'd end up with something similar to what you have in Britain.
Adrian Wilrich?
The side is, I don't think the conservatives are patriotic. I think they're mostly jingoistic.
Okay.
2 points there. First, the first point about the meaning of the term conservative. It's obviously a difficult and problematical term. But one of the interesting things is this was a term which people on the right themselves rejected as recently as the late 1950s. Herbert Hoover was once accused by FDR of being a conservative. He regarded it as an insult because he regarded conservatism as being about the preservation of feudal traditions, old Europe, and all of that sort of thing.
I agree with him.
And he said, no, I'm not a conservative, I'm a classical liberal. Eisenhower said that he wasn't a conservative, that he was a liberal. Not a classical liberal, actually a liberal, I think, was the term that he used. And it's really only in the mid-60s that the movement begins to embrace this term conservative. That Goldwater is the first person who runs for the presidency under the proud label of a conservative. Obviously, it's a problematical term, but I think what John was saying earlier about American conservatism being a strange mixture of exaggerating certain features of classical conservatism and mixing in with them some other features of classical liberalism is exactly right. It's a unique movement. About the campaign finance laws, I simply don't agree. I think there is this idea out there that conservatism is simply something that's imposed by big business, by money men, that it doesn't accurately reflect American opinion. I think that's wrong. If you look at American opinion on a whole range of issues, from the death penalty to abortion to gun rights to what the role of the state is, whether the role of the state is to provide a safety net or to allow people to express their abilities and achieve their personal goals. I think the remarkable thing is that the conservatism is a precise description of where the center of gravity is. The center of gravity, in terms of public opinion, is much to the right in America. It's not just a distortion imposed by campaign finance.
I don't disagree with you. I just say that the public opinion has been formed by money interests.
And Adrian Wilrich, you do trace a lot of the big donors who funded not only campaigns, but institutions like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the rise of those intellectual foundations of modern American
conservatism. Absolutely. I think it's absolutely true that you have had all sorts of organizations, from pressure groups to think tanks, which have very, very deliberately tried to take prejudices and weave them into a political ideology. But nevertheless, I think that if you take something as fundamental as attitudes to the state, this is not something that has been imposed by clever people at the AEI. I think there is something fundamental and long-standing in the United States that's made the country much more skeptical of state intervention, much more enthusiastic about meritocracy, about individuals being left to sink or swim according to their own merits. That's something that's been there for a long time. After all, America has never had a socialist movement, a real, fully-fledged socialist movement. It hasn't got the legacy of attitudes and the legacy of institutions which European countries which have had a socialist movement have had.
Quick question to you, John Micklethwaite. This from Chris in Menlo Park, California, who emails us. It seems to me generally conservatives are rural and liberals urban. Have you found that to be true?
Well, I think it's a tiny bit more complicated than that. There are definitely a lot of rural conservatives, but I think actually the suburbs in some ways is really the area where conservatism has taken off. And again, he's calling from California. Mm-hmm. If you look at the sort of Reagan revolution, that basically began in the suburbs of Southern California. That's where it began to push. So the answer is half right.
We'll continue our discussion with John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wilrich after a short break. More of your calls, too, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with the authors of a new book, The Right Nation, which traces the history of the conservative movement in this country. If you have questions about how conservatism rose from a marginal force in American politics to such prominence in just 50 years or so, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. You can email us as well, TOTN at NPR.org. The authors of the book are John Micklethwaite, U.S. editor for The Economist, and Adrian Woolridge, who's that magazine's Washington correspondent. And let's get another caller on the line. Josh is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am considered a fairly religious person, but the religious right drives me absolutely crazy. And so I guess I'm curious as to what your guests think about how the religion and, I guess, evangelical Christianity became so right-wing and Republican.
Adrian, you want to start on that?
Well, I think that that evangelical Christianity, particularly in its southern form, was for a very, very long time, of course, the Democratic-leaning. It was only really with Jimmy Carter that evangelical Christians had huge faith in Jimmy Carter, huge enthusiasm for his election, and they were disillusioned with him, extremely disillusioned with him, particularly with his the attempt by his Justice Department to force religious schools back into the system. The assumption that religious schools were in some way discriminatory, they were absolutely furious about that. And that you know, they shifted then very strongly towards the Republican Party and to Reagan. And since then, they have been an extremely important a pillar of the Republican coalition. And if you look at, in most European countries, the biggest indicator of whether you're going to be a conservative is your wealth. So people who earn a lot are more conservative than people who earn less. If you look at the election in 2000, people who earn over $100,000 a year, basically they slightly preferred Bush to Gore, but only very slightly. If you look at people who go to church more than once a week, they overwhelmingly support George Bush. So it's much more a religious and cultural divide, the divide between the two parties, than it is an economic divide now.
It's amazing. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Josh. John Micklethwaite, at several points in the book, though, as the caller suggested, being from North Carolina, he said the religious right, he has difficulty with them. A lot of Americans have difficulty with the religious right, and at various points, conservatives in power try to tone down the demands of the religious right.
It's a permanent problem for if you're a Republican president is how much to give to the religious right. And we go through, you know, some length exactly what Bush has done for them and what he hasn't. He remember only about a year or so ago, he was actually in trouble, or the administration was in trouble with religious conservatives over the issue of gay marriage. What had happened was that the Republican chairman had gone to go meet members of a gay rights pressure group, and that had infuriated the religious right, and they were beginning to say that Bush had absolutely done nothing for them on this issue. A really big problem for the Republicans, for a Republican president at least, is that social conservatives are much harder to appease than sort of business conservatives or the anti-tax conservatives. Essentially, it's something to do with culture, I think, is that a business conservative almost by nature is used to doing deals. If, on the other hand, you're a social conservative and you believe very firmly that abortion is killing babies, or you believe that gay marriage is completely immoral, there is really no room for compromise. You're not prepared to say, well, look, we've got rid of partial birth abortion, let's stop there. You're not prepared to say, well, let's forget about, why not have civil unions rather than gay marriage? They're a much harder block to deal with from that point of view, but they are extremely useful as foot soldiers marching to the Republican beat.
Yet, and I just want to pursue this, Adrian Woolridge, Ronald Reagan, who really did not deliver on a lot of his promises to social conservatives on issues like abortion, nevertheless believed God had chosen America as the agent of his special purpose, his capital H special purpose on earth. This is an aspect of American conservatism that provides a lot of force and clarity, yet drives a lot of people crazy.
Absolutely. The identification of God with the purposes of the United States, with the United States as the city on the hill, the chosen nation. The confluence between patriotism and religious belief is a very powerful one on the right, and Ronald Reagan was one of the better people at exploiting and articulating that confluence. But Reagan's own personal attitude to religion is a huge puzzle. I think after he signed a very liberal abortion law in California, mm-hmm. He seldom went to church himself. His attitude to he supported the church rather like a buttress from the outside rather than from inside. He was much less personally, I think, devotional than George W. Bush, yet the religious right absolutely adored him. It's a mystery to me.
Let's talk with Erica, who joins us from Indianapolis.
Yes, I was calling to speak about how, to see if your guests can speak about how the rise of conservatism sort of mirrors the fall of the civil rights movement. It's in particular, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that this conservative movement has been rising over the past 50 years, and this month we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. How does that, or how do you address the issues of race and how Republicans have effectively marginalized the Democratic Party with minorities and have associated those with minorities, and how conservatives may be reacting towards a perceived loss of power, especially for those, especially for Caucasian Americans, white males in particular, and how that affects the rise of conservatism.
Adrian Woolridge, the moment you point to is not Brown versus Board, but the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Absolutely. I think that's an extremely interesting question because it gets to a lot of how the conservative movement has actually changed over the years. I think it's definitely the case that one of the things that gave the conservative movement and Barry Goldwater's campaign in general its initial impetus was opposition to the Civil Rights Act and to the Voting Rights Act. And that was very much white people who'd been traditionally in the Democratic Party, who'd been happy to vote Democratic, so long as they were left with their racist ways in the South. They abandoned the Democratic Party when it embraced civil rights, and they moved to the Republican Party. So the roots of this conservative revolution do lie in that rather dark and murky area of American history. However, I would add that I think the Republican Party has changed significantly since then, and the incident I would point to is the treatment of Trent Lott when he congratulated Strom Thurmond on his 100th birthday and said that had the country gone the way of Strom, which he meant segregation implicitly, we wouldn't have had any of these problems. And the Republican Party pretty rapidly, I mean the White House in particular, pretty rapidly dropped Trent Lott and engineered his downfall. So I think that this party and the conservative movement in general is, whatever its roots and whatever happened in the mid-1960s, I think it's trying, I think it is actually genuinely trying to get beyond that very unpleasant legacy. And also on affirmative action, for example, that I don't think the president tried to really sidestep that question, but the Supreme Court has come down in favor of affirmative action. So on this area, I think we haven't moved as much to the right as someone like Barry Goldwater would have wanted, and the country's a much better place for it.
Erica, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Email question from Ron in Pittsburgh, California. Can you define neocons and put them in the context to what you're talking about today? John Micklethwaite.
Difficult. Well, the interesting thing about neoconservatives is so many people assume they're sort of like an extreme version of conservatives. In fact, it's completely the opposite. They call themselves neoconservatives to begin with, at least, because they were Democrats. They came from the Democrat side of the thing. They were typically Democrat academics. They were typically urban, often Jewish, which has become controversial. But at the time, they were people who'd been excluded wrongly from universities like Harvard. They worked their way up through urban universities in New York. And what horrified them, and where they started was in the 1960s, what horrified them was the idea of lots of middle-class students protesting vigorously against the Vietnam War, burning flags and stuff like that, which infuriated them because their parents, a lot of them had escaped the Holocaust, and they thought that people who attacked America were on the wrong side. And they began to question, not in a racist way to tie it into the previous caller, mm-hmm. they began to question a lot of the affirmative action and other programs that came out in the 1960s because they thought they wouldn't work in practice. And that was the first generation of neoconservatives. The current generation of neoconservatives, who strangely, biologically, are often linked to the former, so you have Bill Kristol, son of Irving Kristol, they have taken a slightly more aggressive attitude towards foreign policy, obviously over the Middle East. But that, again, was there to some extent from the beginning. The original neocons were not terribly enthusiastic about the United Nations, always very strong supporters of Israel and so on. Neoconservatism is a one bit of the conservative movement. I think on the whole it tends to get exaggerated. I mean, from our point of view, the interesting thing about neoconservatives were that they were to some extent a fringe intellectual end of the conservative movement. And then just after September 11th, they happened, all the things they've been going on about happened to make extraordinary sense to the rest of the conservative movement. Suddenly the idea of these people saying, look, we shouldn't get involved in multilateral alliances, America should be much stronger abroad, and watch out for terrorism, watch out for weapons of mass destruction, that resonated right the way across the right nation, as we call it. And so in a sense, it was, a lot of people see it as a sort of the Manchurian candidate. I'd rather see it as a sort of Harry Potter thing at the time. It's suddenly the small boy in specs at the back of the class was suddenly the school hero. Of course, it's all gone wrong since then in many ways. But the neoconservatives are part of the right, but you shouldn't give too great a role to them.
Let's get another caller. Lorenzo from Oakland, California.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay.
I was very struck by the initial description of the book, which seemed to contrast American conservatism with European conservatism. And what was striking to me was what you described to distinguish American conservatism, which were basically that it was a movement, that it had lots of people, troops, you called it, and an ideology and an exaggerated patriotism and so forth, that in the early part of the 20th century, precisely such movements grew up in Europe, which did not call themselves conservatism, but which contrasted themselves to conservatism, also contrasted themselves to liberalism and socialism, and were a great deal like what you're describing. That is to say, they had troops, they were more militant, and they integrated aspects of what they called their opponents' ideology. You talked about the...
I'm just trying to get to the question here, Lorenzo. You're talking about fascists, right?
Well, yes. Fascism as the final version of those kinds of extreme nationalisms that had the same contrast to classical conservatism that they were describing among with respect to the American movement compared to Europe.
John Micklethwaite, in the book, you directly address this question and say that, in fact, there are important distinctions between American conservatism and fascism.
Well, in fact, that's one of the really interesting things at the moment. If you were going to argue about the rights and wrongs of having this, you know, powerful conservative movement in America, one thing you could say in its favor is that the American has largely avoided having the extreme far-right parties that Europe has, like Jean-Marie Le Pen, like what's happened in Switzerland, what's happened in Holland, where you have very, very tough anti-immigrant and, one, some people say, closer to fascist parties still existing. Of course, many people in Europe regard George W. Bush as a hard-right figure, but I don't think you can really see him in those terms. That would be my response.
And Adrian Woolridge, you also point out that just as the conservative movement in America has sort of excluded the fascists and the various Nazi parties and militias that we've seen in this country, the Democratic Party and liberals have more or less emasculated socialists and communists.
Absolutely. And I would say to the previous caller, there is one of the fundamental intellectual differences between American conservatism and fascism is attitudes to the state. Fascism was all about worship of the state, of the corporate nation, of subsuming individuals within this sort of corporate hierarchy. American conservatism has at its heart, really, an extreme individualism, an extreme hostility to the state.
The cowboy.
The cowboy. So I think they're very, very
Halliburton-argued
movements.
Otherwise.
Okay. Lorenzo, thanks very much for the call. We're talking with the authors of a new book called The Right Nation. They are John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge. In real life, they work for The Economist magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get an email. This from Kenneth. I think it's sorting out the names. I think it's Kenneth. Have the authors of this book heard of the American political theory called the realignment theory, which demonstrates how American politics realigns itself from conservative to liberal every 30 years or so? I just wanted to point out that even if it's true that America may be realigning itself conservatively, it's not necessarily a permanent thing. Adrian?
I think it's certainly not necessarily a permanent thing. Anybody who thinks something is permanent about politics is likely to be rendered rather superfluous with each coming election. But I do think that there has been a fairly relentless swing of the pendulum since the mid-1960s, particularly about attitudes to the role of the state in redistribution, in helping the poor, away from the liberal assumptions of Kennedy and Johnson towards a much more conservative set of assumptions. And what's interesting is the way that this attitude, this conservative attitude, has advanced not just under Republican presidents, but also under Democratic presidents. You know, the most swinging changes in welfare rules took place under Bill Clinton, admittedly under the pressure from a conservative Congress. So I don't believe in any inevitable realignments or non-realignments, whether it's every 30 years or every 50 years. But I do see a fundamental set of values in the United States which are skeptical about the state, enthusiastic about individualism, and I see the conservative movement as being particularly good at articulating those values and using them to lever political power in their direction.
Here's an email question from Luke White. As a libertarian who usually votes Republican, I feel no ideological affinity with the current administration or the neoconservative movement, which seem to advocate an intrusive federal government and state, private, and economic rights. He goes on to say that the Libertarian Party would be the party of traditional conservative founders such as F.A. Hayek, William F. Buckley, and Barry Goldwater, and asks where the change took place. And along with answering that, and I'll put this to you, John Micklethwaite, there are a lot of strains of that conservative, all the streams of conservatism that are groaning a little bit under present circumstances. So certainly deficit hawks, the anti-tax people, there are complaints with the leadership in Washington. And is this going to be significant as well?
Well, I think it is significant. I think the best way to think of the conservative movement, and you know, we wander all the way around America in this book, sort of seeing little bits of it here and there, is essentially it's a bit like a kind of medieval army, where you have lots of people. The job of Karl Rove or George Bush, to some extent, is to make sure that all these different sort of militias turn up. You've got the sort of anti-gun people, you've got the libertarian people, you've got the anti-tax people, you've got the religious right. They often would be in conflict about things. The key thing is to get them all on your side when the election happens. And yes, there are plenty of libertarians who are angry with Bush about Iraq. For what it's worth, there's also on the other side of the Conservative Party, of the Republican Party, if you want to depict it that way, you've got people like the paleoconservatives, like Pat Buchanan and people like that, who are also furious with the neocons. It is a problem. I still think that Bush fundamentally has got what he's been very good at on the whole is keeping his base fairly intact, and he has begun to scare them fairly mightily about John Kerry, rightly or wrongly.
And that may be a theme that continues. We may see throughout the summer and indeed into the fall. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for coming in to talk about your new book today.
Thank you very much for having us.
John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge are the authors of a new book called The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. They are also employees of The Economist magazine. John Micklethwaite was at the offices of The Economist in London. Adrian Woolridge here in Studio 3A in Washington. When we come back from a short break, continuity in Congress. A new bill aims to keep the legislative branch running in the wake of catastrophe. Some say it doesn't go far enough. You can join us in that conversation. We'll be speaking with two members of Congress, 800-989-8255, or email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.